We have thus far covered three of the four main speeches of Elihu, and it is worth remembering that this relatively young man plays a vital role in the whole book of Job, in the way the message of the book of Job is developed. So it is not true to say that his speeches are an abrupt and unwelcome interruption to the flow. On the contrary, they undergird the entire book, and they help to answer the $64 question, which is, why, when God spoke, did he not apparently answer the burning question in the heart of Job? Why do the righteous suffer apparently needless affliction? And this is a clue which I'm giving you in advance, and the secret will be disclosed, of course, in the final lesson. So bear in mind that Elihu plays a pivotal role in the development of the message. A quick recap is important because there are many, many thoughts and ideas that are contained in his speeches, and for the most part, you cannot find fault either with the logic or with the wisdom of Elihu's speeches. The only area where you can perhaps fault him is that he went a little too far. He did, to some extent, misunderstand Job. But by and large, there is a great deal of value in what he says, and they are certainly to the point and accurate. So in his first speech, what is the key idea in the first speech? The key idea is that affliction is not merely punitive, that is to say, it is not merely given in the sense of a cause-effect relationship. You sin, you suffer. You do good, you are blessed. According to Elihu, that is not necessarily the case. It may also be that affliction is sent by God to discipline us because we already have a built-in bias towards sin. So it is necessary for us to be checked from time to time so that we do not slide automatically into sin. This may seem obvious, but it really is a very fresh perspective, because all the speeches given by Job's three friends, men of his own stature, men accounted to be wise, went in the direction of the brutal application of the law of double retribution, which is very crudely, you sin, you suffer, you do good, God is obliged to bless you in this life. But Elihu now brings a fresh perspective, which is really unique, because he says that besides the punitive part of affliction, there is a disciplinary value. In the second speech, Elihu started out by summarizing all the points that Job has been making, and in essence, it amounts to this, what Job has been saying, the thesis of Job, that sometimes God, for reasons known only to himself, appears to sidestep justice in that he ordains affliction upon those who are upright in heart, whereas according to the rules of justice which he himself has established, there is no reason for afflictions to be visited upon the upright in heart. So this is the crux of Job's thesis, one of the key points anyway, that a God who is supposed to be just, for some peculiar reason at times, appears to bend his own rules. Elihu says that even though appearances may lead one to that conclusion, we must check ourselves, because God remains always fair and just, whatever the appearances to the contrary may be. At the crux of Elihu's argument, which is a very carefully reasoned argument, goes like this. Firstly, justice and the power to rule are conjoined in one and the same person who is the ideal ruler. If that is the case, then it is not possible for a ruler who does not respect justice to rule. That, at any rate, was the view in the ancient world. And that view is completely natural if you consider that the various functions of government, the legislative, the judicial, and the administrative aspects of government in the ancient world were always combined in one person, one office and one person, whom we call for convenience the ideal ruler. It is not so in the modern world. These functions of government are split up and they do lead to complications of their own. So according to the argument of Elihu, you cannot have the power to rule. We cannot have someone sitting in power ruling if that person doesn't honor justice. And justice certainly is the foundation of God's rule, because he has himself declared it. So unless you want to maintain that God is a liar, and you would have a really tough time trying to prove that thesis, then you have to take God at his word when he says that he is just. So justice is the foundation of his rule. And we see this in real life in the following ways. God, if you look at it impartially, God never over-punishes, never under-punishes, and his actions, his punishment always comes on time, never late, never premature. If therefore, according to Elihu, Job is correct in asserting that God sometimes is unjust, then by the first thesis, the first premise, then God cannot be all-powerful, because it's a kind of a syllogism, major thesis, major premise, minor premise, and the conclusion, the major premise being that justice and the power to rule are inseparable. So if Job is correct in saying that God sometimes sidesteps justice, then he cannot be all-powerful. But Job continues to insist, and rightly, that God is omnipotent. Therefore, and this is an unavoidable conclusion, that the major premise has to be flawed. It cannot be that God at times bypasses justice. So it may appear somewhat mechanistic, but Elihu is following the kind of logic and argument that Job himself followed. So it's really quite fair. Now Elihu says, having demolished Job's argument, he says, on the contrary, God judges all men with strict impartiality and by the same set of laws. He makes no concession to a person's heritage, his lineage, no concession to a person's track record, no concessions to a person's connections, family connections. Same laws to apply to everyone. And God is able, and only God is able to do this, because all things are naked and open before his eyes. It is not so with fellow human beings, because human beings are limited. They cannot know exactly what goes on, particularly in the heart of a sinner. But to God, there are no secrets and there are no mysteries. Therefore, God is able at all times to apply the same set of laws with strict impartiality. And now Elihu brings a very interesting insight upon the afflictions of Job. He says to Job, whatever may have been the cause for God to visit these afflictions upon you, let's not argue about that, because it's a fact of that is before you and before us. You are suffering, and as far as anyone can tell, you don't deserve it. So granted. So whatever it was that moved or motivated God to visit these afflictions upon you, your action, Job, in continuing to complain really adds to your former sin, whatever it may have been, this new sin of rebellion. It is sobering to realize that rebellion covers a fairly wide spectrum. There is, of course, the open rebellion where we challenge God, where we oppose God, where we question God. But it is sobering to realize that if we continue complaining about God, to God, particularly in terms of, God, this is unfair to me, I have not deserved anything like this, why have you sent these troubles upon me, why have you done this to my son or daughter, they are innocent. If this spirit of complaining continues, then Elihu says, please realize that this is a facet of rebellion, and that God takes very seriously indeed. So Elihu is giving a truly fresh insight for Job to consider, that perhaps if he were to stop complaining and surrender himself to the will of God in his suffering, these afflictions might be lifted sooner than he expected. And indeed, even in my own life, going back 5 years or 6 years ago, I had pretty much the same kind of experience. And in short, what it amounted to is, the more I complained about God to God, the longer my afflictions continued. But when I surrendered the whole matter to God and said, let your will be done, bit by bit, those afflictions have gradually been lifted. And today, when I read Elihu's speech, it strikes home to me, because I have myself experienced it. I can assure you that in this regard, Elihu is certainly 100% correct. Don't add to your sin the fresh sin of complaining, because it's not going to get you anywhere with God. That's the second speech. The third speech takes up the whole of chapter 35 and is basically composed of two parts. Elihu sets out Job's rights as he had claimed them in the first four verses of chapter 35. And then, as if he was speaking for God, Elihu presents God's sovereign rights. So it's fair. He recites the rights that Job had claimed, and since no one interrupted him, we have to assume that silence is consent, that they had no reason to fault him. So he had correctly presented Job's so-called rights. And now Elihu presents, almost as if he is a spokesman, he presents God's rights, sovereign rights, in verses 5 through 15. If you cast your mind back, you will recall, we are not faulting Job. It's perfectly understandable that he responded in this way. But you will recall that Job had dwelt at great length on his righteous lifestyle, his integrity, his care for employees and slaves, his compassion for the needy in his community, and his hospitality towards strangers. So indirectly saying, I have done all these good and noble things, I am surely entitled to better treatment from God. That is the unspoken argument besides listing out all the good things he had done. And then Job, and you can't doubt this, he had frequently questioned whether God had been fair and just in dealing with him, particularly in sending wave upon wave of affliction upon a person who arguably had not done anything to merit such treatment. What Elihu says to Job is this: this line of argument, Job, amounts to saying that in effect you are more righteous than God, because what you're saying is, here you are giving such a beautiful picture of yourself, which is on the face of it correct, is not an exaggeration. You have been righteous, you have been a man of integrity, you have cared for your employees and slaves, you have had sincere compassion for the needy, you have always shown hospitality to strangers, and you have always been consistent in worshipping God, in offering the sacrifices that are prescribed for sin. You have been very particular in that. But if you keep harping upon that, you and then at the same time, in the same breath, saying that God has been unfair in visiting you with these afflictions, then it amounts to saying that God's righteousness doesn't measure up to yours. And that is quite a terrible thing to say. Therefore, Elihu says, I will now take upon myself this task of justifying the ways of God to men. As he says in verse 4 of chapter 35, I, Elihu, will answer thee and thy companions with thee. If you cast your mind back to chapter 22, you'll realize that Eliphaz had also attempted such a role, to try and put Job right, to argue with Job, reason with Job rather, and show him where he's wrong. But unfortunately, Eliphaz and the two other friends got sidetracked into framing baseless accusations against Job, which vitiated their whole line of reasoning. But Elihu, the younger man, a man who's completely unknown, whose parentage, his lineage is unknown, who has no obvious social standing, comes forth with such pearls of wisdom. And what is more to the point here, he doesn't allow himself to be sidetracked, because the issue is not to frame accusations against Job, but rather to clear up the confusion in Job's mind. So Elihu stays focused, and we have to remember that as we read his speeches. What Elihu has been trying to do is this: he's been trying to demonstrate to Job and to his three friends that, contrary to what Job thinks, that God does not take cognizance of the good that men do, that God is sometimes whimsical in the way he gives blessing or withholds blessing or sends affliction, Elihu is trying to demonstrate to Job that God is so exalted that he cannot be affected, nor can he be swayed by whatever man may do or fail to do. God's judgments are always impartial and to the point. At the same time, and this is important for Job to realize, and Elihu is telling him to his face, however righteous, however noble you may have been, and let's accept that without argument, neither you nor anyone else has the right to demand of God an explanation of why God does something or refrains from doing what you expect Him to do. Because of the exalted nature of God, He is not obliged to explain to us the reason for His acting in a certain way or the reason for His failing to act. Therefore, Elihu reminds Job, if you have received a blessing from God, and certainly Job had received many blessings from God, don't take it that you deserve it and therefore God is being just, He's giving you what you deserve. Even when you have done the best that you can possibly do, you remain nothing more than an unprofitable servant. Therefore, Job, whatever blessings you receive, it is because of God's grace and mercy. It's not an issue of I deserve it, I get it, and there's nothing more to be said. All fair and square. Whatever I do will never be enough to counteract the sin in my life, and therefore I will never deserve anything good from God. And therefore, if I do receive blessings from God, it is really because of God's grace and mercy. And that puts a stop to this complaining spirit. By the same token, and this is where what is maybe difficult to accept for Job and for us, by the same token, if and when you are afflicted, it is either because you deserve it, so this is the punitive action of God, or else because God is trying to discipline you that you do not at some future point slide into sin. Again, recall the thorn in the flesh that St. Paul was given and which he prayed so hard that it be removed, and God's final and answer to him, which put a stop to all further petitions, is, my grace is sufficient for you. In other words, I am not obliged to explain everything to you. Even if you do not, by your standards, deserve this thorn in the flesh, I have put it there. And Paul says that perhaps it is because of the great revelations that were given to him to keep him humble, he was so afflicted. So that is an illustration. Of course, Job couldn't see forward to the time of St. Paul, but we can because we are looking back. We do realize better than Job ever could that the afflictions of God are not always punitive in measure. If they were, then it's a very mechanistic relationship between the Creator and the creature. You do good, you're blessed. You do wrong, you're cursed. And there is no room or scope for anything else. But where God is concerned, the relationship between Him and us is never mechanical. Because of the intervention of grace and mercy. So when you are afflicted and you cannot see any good reason for it, then accept the fact that there is a disciplinary value in it. Why then does God seem to hold back giving relief to Job? Because in Job's view, this silence of God encourages the wicked to carry on in their ways and at the same time discourages the suffering righteous people. So really, God is not helping the situation by sometimes remaining silent as he was in the case of Job. Elihu says, that line of reasoning is false and it's not going to lead you anywhere, because that line of reasoning misrepresents the manner in which God administers creation. Elihu's argument to Job, which we covered last week, is this. It may well be that if your petitions for relief, for whatever, are met with silence from God, it may be because the manner in which you send those petitions up is incorrect, meaning to say that particularly when you are afflicted, the tendency is to become so preoccupied with your afflictions that you fail to practice proper intercessory prayer. And we gave an example of that Psalm 31. You'll realize if you read Psalm 31 that you don't, in your praying and intercessory prayer, you don't make yourself the be-all and the end-all of intercessory prayer. Meaning, from the word go, you start off by listing all the things that why you deserve the better treatment at the hands of God, why you deserve that this petition be answered, and then present the petition. On the contrary, all the examples of effective intercessory prayers that we find in the Bible contain this element of praise and thanksgiving, which may be difficult for the suffering person to render to God, but yet every example of effective intercessory prayer never starts off by plunging into, these are my problems, I'm suffering, I need relief, oh Lord, send me relief because I've done all these for you. There have been people who have prayed like that and, like Job, have been met with silence from God until they change their approach. And this is what is new, which Job needed to learn at the mouth of a younger man, and this is what Elihu is trying to get across to him. If you become so preoccupied with your misery and fail to start off by praising and thanking God and acknowledging that God knows what He is doing, even if it may not be to your expectations, then don't be surprised, Job, if all you end up with is the silence from God. In other words, you, in trying to pray an intercessory prayer, whether for yourself or for others, you cannot come to God with preconditions. For all his righteousness and goodness, Job did show this weakness, that when he prayed to God and cried out to God, the manner in which he did it shows clearly that he had a certain set of preconditions. The preconditions being, I have done all these good things, I have been righteous, I have never failed to confess any sin, I have offered the prescribed sacrifices for sin, I have been very consistent, and therefore you need to hear me. So that is the kind of precondition that would destroy any attempt at intercessory prayer. What Elihu is saying is, Job, you need to come to God just as you are, in a spirit of submission to His will. If you don't, then it is more than likely that you will be met with the silence of God. If you approach God in the right spirit, by praising and thanking God and acknowledging that God has the right to do whatever He deems fit, whether or not you understand it, then for sure you will receive grace to endure during the night seasons, to sing during the night seasons, as Paul and Silas did when they were in the Philippian jail. And we went through that example in detail last week. We must realize that Paul and Silas were not singing their hearts and heads off, because they were trying to psych themselves up into a positive frame of mind. It's impossible to do that when you are in a rat-infested, waterlogged dungeon, when your hands are chained, your feet are bound to heavy wooden blocks, and the floor of the dungeon is littered with waste, human waste, and you can hear, even if you can't see, the rats scampering about. There's no way in which you can psych yourself up to sing praises to God unless you truly have the right spirit within you, a spirit that can rise above your circumstances. And that is the next point of value in the message of Elihu. He explains to Job that a believer's true source of equanimity and joy cannot lie in circumstances that are external, because these can change, these can vanish. And if you depend on external circumstances, then when circumstances are oppressive or you are undergoing severe physical suffering, your whole peace of mind, your joy of living, your trust in God, your faith in God can be shaken very easily. On the other hand, like Paul and Silas, if you were to appreciate the fact that by virtue of God's grace, nothing can separate you from the love of God, that realization will always give you the grace to sing in the midst of affliction. And of course, in order to do that, you need to have at the outset a clean conscience. There's no way in which you can experience this peace of God that enables you to sing in your times of affliction if you know jolly well that there is unconfessed sin in your life. So it's really a comprehensive package. All of the elements have to be in place, and you cannot have lapses here and there. In order for you to rise above your circumstances, in order for your petitions to be heard by God, and in order for you eventually to receive the blessing from God. Elihu then goes on to remind Job there is one other problem with man, and that is pride. And pride is a tricky thing, because very often people take pride in their humility. This may sound like an oxymoron, but it is really often the case that people do take pride in being humble. Good example would have been King Saul, or before he was king, when he was summoned to appear before the people, he hid behind bushels of corn. Now, we sometimes take that for humility, but if you read the context carefully, it is certainly not a proper example of humility. It's a false kind of humility. It's a perverted form of pride, really. So we have to be careful about pride. It's a really slippery eel. And pride in the heart of man is such a stubborn thing, such a tough nut to crack, that affliction will not necessarily break pride in the heart of man. Other factors may be broken, but pride will not be broken. If you look at the example of Lucifer and the fate to which he was confined, he would still not repent or acknowledge his sin because of this element of pride. So pride is quite unique, because it is not necessarily broken or even influenced by affliction. So Elihu reminds Job that pride may also be a factor in the fact that you are continuing to suffer. And at the same time, Elihu says, just because we cannot directly observe God, we cannot see and touch God, does not mean, as Job was trying to insinuate, that God has removed himself from the affairs of men. God doesn't need to be standing right in our midst, talking to us, clapping us on the back when we do good, scolding us audibly when we do wrong. God doesn't need to be perceptible by our physical senses, because he has declared himself to be present everywhere and at all times. So he is intimately involved in the affairs of human beings. If he were not intimately involved in the affairs of human beings, God could not execute justice in the world. Therefore, this is Elihu's message to Job. why don't you change your tack and simply put your trust in God instead of trying to argue your case legally that you are innocent and you shouldn't be given this treatment. You might do it with human beings, but it is futile to do it with God, because there's no way you can build your case against God. And even if you went to the divine court, God is judge, jury and executioner. Not to say that he is partial towards himself, but he is by definition judge, jury, executioner. How are you going to win your case against that kind of adversary who is also your judge and who will be your executioner? So Job, this is not the way to approach God. Why don't you come childlike in trust, lay your petitions before him and learn to wait, painful though it may be. Why don't you learn to wait? Because Job by this point in time had become excessively anxious. Quite understandable, when we are ourselves suffering and undergoing affliction, it is quite natural for us to want a quick end to all of this. It's natural for us to want God to relieve us and to show us again his smile, his favor. But this kind of anxiety is not helping our case, because it's going to lead us into murmuring and complaining, which Job unfortunately was guilty of doing from time to time, and that's not going to help at all. And Elihu's conclusion at the close of his third speech is this, that Job's complaints bearing upon the severity of his afflictions vis-a-vis his track record, those complaints are groundless, have no foundation, no basis before a just and holy God. We come now to the fourth and final speech. The outline is given on the whiteboard. There are basically four parts to it. In the first part, he presents his credentials for instructing Job and his friends, and then in the next part, verses 5 through 15, Elihu expounds on the disciplinary value of affliction. He follows that in chapter 36, verses 16 through 21, with a warning to Job. And he then concludes with a declamation on the greatness and splendor of God, which runs from chapter 36, verse 22, all the way to the end of chapter 37. The last part is very important because it prepares the way for God to speak. It is almost like a herald sounding a trumpet announcing that God is now going to speak. So the greatness and splendor of God we will cover next lesson. Today we will cover the first three parts of his fourth and final speech. Why does he begin in verses 1 through 4 with an overture along the following lines? He says, for example, in verse 2, suffer me a little, bear with me, and I will show thee that I have yet to speak on God's behalf. There are a number of reasons for this. Firstly, it's a matter of courtesy, because he was a much younger man. He was a man who was not publicly recognized as a wise man, and he was certainly not a leader in his community. Therefore, he needed to lead the way into his speech, because he is going to say some very hard-hitting things. Therefore, he has to be polite, respecting the age and seniority of his audience. Suffer me a little, and I will show thee that I have yet to speak. Also, because if you think back to all the chapters in the book of Job which cover the dialogue, you will realize that there have been really three cycles of speeches by Job and his friends. In each of those cycles, Job has spoken thrice. Up to this point in time, Elihu has already spoken thrice. And now he is going to speak one more time, one more than the others have spoken. Each in turn has spoken thrice in each of the three cycles, except for Zophai, the last cycle. Elihu has already done his quarter of three cycles. So again, as a matter of courtesy, he is asking leave to speak a further fourth time. And the justification he claims for speaking more often than the others is interesting. He says, for example, in verse 2, I have yet to speak on God's behalf. What does that mean? It means more needs to be said to explain the way God administers the world. And he, Elihu, is going to do that. Secondly, second justification for wanting to speak more often than Job and his friends, I will fetch my knowledge from afar. Please don't get sidetracked into thinking that he is so arrogant. It is just a poetic way of saying, what I now have to say to you, my seniors, will not be a rehash, a repeat of what we've already debated, but it's going to be something fresh. There will be fresh insights which I'm going to offer. Third justification that Elihu gives for speaking more often, truly my words shall not be false. Verse 4. Why does he have to say this? Because in the speeches of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, Job accused them of speaking wickedly for God. What does that mean? You can read that in chapter 13, verses 7 and 8. Will ye speak wickedly for God and talk deceitfully for him? And so on. So, the three friends made that mistake. Their mistake was speaking wickedly for God means using unsound arguments to try and justify God's treatment of Job. And indeed, when God finally speaks, he reprimands the three friends for this specific reason. He says, you have not spoken of me the things that are right. In other words, God is telling the three friends, you went to Job as his comforters, as his advisors, and all you have done is to misrepresent the Lord God to his suffering servant and confuse the poor man. Elihu says, my word shall not be false, meaning I will not use any such false, unsound arguments to justify God's treatment of Job. And the fourth justification he gives for speaking more often than the others is in verse 4. He that is perfect in knowledge is with thee. Again, don't get sidetracked into thinking he is so arrogant in thinking that he has perfect knowledge. Again, it is a poetic metaphor. All it amounts to is this, a confident assertion that whatever he is going to expound now is sound and therefore worthy of their attention. So with this overture, he is now able to embark upon the next section, which is the disciplinary value of affliction. At the outset, says Elihu, we have to recognize that God, because of his greatness, is independent of all created beings, that nothing can constrain him by means of threats or favors or obligations. Thus God is by definition completely impartial in his dealings with men. Not only that, he is a God of compassion because he constantly watches over those who reverence him, whatever their present condition may be, so as to exalt them in due season. Why is this relevant? Because one of the key issues in the heated debate between Job and his friends was this: whether the afflictions that a person experiences in his life at a given point in time, whether those afflictions constitute a barometer to indicate one's character in the sight of God. As you know, a barometer goes and up and down depending on the air pressure, which again is related to the likelihood of rainfall. So can we now look at the afflictions that befall a person and say, oh, you are out of favor with God, or you are in favor with God? Can you do that? That is in effect misusing the law of double retribution, which is a mistake that the three friends and Job were making all the way up to this point in time. And indeed, the position of the three friends mistakenly applying the law of double retribution was this. Job may call himself righteous, but he is actually a righteous hypocrite who therefore deserves the afflictions visited upon him. And of course, Job takes the opposite view. He's not going to say that, I agree, I'm a righteous hypocrite. Firstly, because he knows he's not. And secondly, because he is incensed at his three friends who came to comfort him and who are now framing all kinds of accusations to justify God sending afflictions upon Job, as if God needs human beings to justify him sending afflictions upon one particular individual. So Job is naturally incensed. So he says, on the contrary, my example shows that God sometimes appears to forsake the ungodly. So there are these two extreme views. The views of the three friends that yes, whether you have afflictions or blessings is a good barometer of your standing in the sight of God. Job's view, which is a reaction to the three friends, the other opposite, which is God is sometimes quite unfair. Elihu takes the middle ground. He says, yes, the righteous may at times be afflicted by God, but they are never forsaken. We can appreciate this because we have the testimony of St. Paul, but it must have been pretty tough for Job and his friends to realize this, to appreciate this. But Elihu was spot on. The righteous may at times be afflicted, but they are never forsaken. And it is in that scenario that we see the mercy, the justice, and the compassion of God rolled into one. God has the sovereign right to send afflictions upon anyone he chooses at any time. There's no argument and no question about it, simply because of his absolute sovereignty. We also know that the character of God is that of a righteous and holy God. Therefore, he will not, by his own standard, he will not act capriciously. Therefore, if a righteous man is afflicted, his comfort is he will never be forsaken. And indeed, the testimony of Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 verses 8 and 9 helps us to appreciate this point. Paul writes, we are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, confused, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. Unfortunately, Job didn't have the value of this testimony, and this is indeed yet one of many illustrations to show the unity and the integrity of the Bible, how it is that the New Testament sheds light on the Old, and the Old Testament looks forward to the New. Elihu's message, surprising for his time, is this, that an all-wise, loving, and compassionate God may, as he sees fit, use affliction as a means of discipline, either to punish for sin or as a preventive measure to check our propensity to sin. But be that as it may, God's objective in sending affliction, and this is most important for us to realize, even if it is because of our sin and we are being punished, or whether it is because there is a disciplinary value, a preventive value in it, whatever the specific case may be, God's overriding objective in sending affliction upon a person is to refine that person, not to destroy the person. And this is something which will give us great comfort when we ourselves undergo affliction. Since Job was getting so far out of sync with God, Elihu in his third part, in the third part of his speech, chapter 36, verses 16 through 21, sounds a warning to Job, and it goes along these lines. Please look at the first part of verse 16, chapter 36, verse 16. Even so would he have removed thee out of the strait into a broad place where there is no straightness. I'll explain that in a minute, but focus on the word straight there. Straightness and strait reflect a typically Hebrew perspective, which is that affliction, just like if you are caught in a find yourself in a narrow passage, if let's say you are exploring an underground cave and you get lost and you are trapped in a very narrow passage, there's hardly any room to turn. If you have gone forward, the only way to get out is to walk backwards. You can't turn, and you realize it can be very claustrophobic. Your movements are severely constricted. In like manner, afflictions, this is from the Hebrew philosophical perspective, when afflictions fall upon you, they constrain or constrict the options that you have for getting on with your life. So this is why the word straight and straightness is used. And in the second part of the same verse, and that which should be set on thy table should be full of fatness, which of course reminds us of Psalm 23 verse 5. Thou preparest a table of goodies before me in the presence of mine enemies. Then verses 17 and 18. But thou hast fulfilled, thou Job, hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold on thee. Because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with his stroke, then a great ransom cannot deliver thee. 19. Will he esteem thy riches? No, not gold, nor all the forces of strength. What are these forces of strength? They would be typically reputation, wisdom, seniority, and social status. This verse 19 is a rather difficult verse, whether in the Hebrew or in the English, to understand. But looking at the context, we can glean the meaning of this verse, which goes like this. Verse 19, paraphrase, do not seek a quick release from your affliction, Job, by seeking death. Not when your frame of mind towards God is not right. In these verses that we have covered, what are the key points that Elihu is making? Verses 16 through 19, the key points are these. There are three if conditions. If Job had been patient, resigning himself to God and to God's will, his afflictions would surely have been lifted by now and his prosperity restored. That is verse 16. Even so would he have removed thee out of the strait caused by afflictions into a broad place and your table should be full of fatness. Had you been patient and resigned yourself to God's will, your afflictions would have been lifted long before this and your prosperity restored. If Job were to manifest the spirit of stubbornness rather than that of a penitent, then he should expect the same fate that befalls those who remain stubborn. This is verse 17. But thou hast fulfilled, it's really an if condition thou that is there, although it's written as if it's already happened. But thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked, judgment and justice take hold on thee. If you continue to manifest the spirit of stubbornness rather than that of a penitent, then you, Job, should expect the same fate that befalls such people. And the third if condition is in verses 18 and 19. Because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with his stroke, then a great ransom cannot deliver thee. Will he esteem thy riches? No, not gold, nor all the forces of strength. If Job were to continue with his protestations that God has not been fair to him, then he runs the risk of being cut off suddenly without any further warning. And verse 21 that concludes this section on the warning to Job: take heed, regard not iniquity, for this hast thou chosen rather than affliction. Paraphrase, it would read as follows: be careful, be circumspect. Elihu is addressing Job. Be circumspect in formulating your views of God's administration of the world, that you do not fall into sin. After all, you, Job, have resorted to complaining to God about his ways and means instead of submitting patiently to your afflictions. There is certainly more than a grain of truth in what Elihu has to say, because we can see the same weakness in us. It is a common human failing. Many of us fall into sin because of our spirit of resentment towards God. Resentment because God, instead of blessing us, has sent all these troubles and afflictions upon us. And if we are not careful and we don't check it, this spirit of resentment will lead us to murmur and complain. And that becomes really a serious sin, a sin tantamount to rebellion, which God will not take lightly. We have covered the first three parts of his final speech. Next week, God willing, we will complete the fourth part of Elihu's final speech, which runs from chapter 36, verse 22 through the end of chapter 37. And after that, there should be one final lesson which covers chapters 38 through 42. And with that, we should be done with the book of Job.